And my apologies to those of you who have come out to this regular meeting that we have here. A little late today. Sorry about that. I did come home from work last night. I'm running a fever and completely stopped up. I may actually have to pause to sniffle once in a while when we're going through these three of the last five chapters of Epiphany. So I say apologies in advance. Checking to see where my tissues are. Oh, and pardon me on that. Anyway, we are back in West Virginia right now with chapter 28. Our friendly neighborhood sheriff just left Parsons and is on his way here. Beasley's voice cut through a dream Dan was having about being in a peaceful place, one which did not involve being chased by someone intent on putting him behind bars. He'll likely have a deputy here, if there's not one here already, to keep an eye on the place to see that we don't escape. Dan's head was still in the process of clearing. We need to get out of here, now. She yanked off his covers, exposing him to the still cold air of the morning in the mountains. He was exposed, naked, without protection. Here, she said, handing him a pair of trousers. Put these on while I get you a shirt. He swung his legs over the side of the bed, hoping that she wouldn't notice, or if she did notice, she wouldn't say anything about his ebbing erection. He barely got his trousers on and had been given on when she came through the door again and threw him a shirt. Hamner and our doubles are heading down to the checkpoint now, Beasley informed him, while he was pulling a t-shirt over his head. They'll divert attention long enough for us to get away. "Where are my shoes?" Dan asked. "Your shoes and socks are in the car," she told him. "Once we're out of this jurisdiction, we'll stop long enough so you can get them on." Beasley shepherded Dan out to an Arrest Me Red Mustang convertible, dumping him into the passenger seat before she went around the car to drive it. Before they'd gotten 500 feet, Agent Hamner's voice came crackling on the radio. "Seems the deputy took the bait," Beasley explained while picking up speed. They're headed north on the main highway towards Davis with a pair of deputies in hot pursuit. I take it we're headed south, Dan postulated. Nope, she smiled. They're expecting to be tricked like that. The sheriff will have the south road covered, anticipating that we'll head in that direction. We're going to go right past the group headed north. And a car that couldn't be more obvious, Dan commented. Exactly, Beasley chortled. Sure enough, when they got to Davis, they saw a group of police and government vehicles massed in a parking lot with half a dozen or more people out of their cars involved in a loud argument. Beasley drove by without missing a beat, continuing north without a word until they crossed over into Maryland. "Where are we headed?" Dan asked when they passed the intersection of U.S. Highway 50. "Magnolia, the long way," Beasley responded. "We'll be avoiding the interstate in West Virginia, except for a short stretch going through Wheeling to get to Ohio. After we get some breakfast, I'm going to have you drive for a while so I can catch a nap." They pulled into a small restaurant in Oakland where they had a quick breakfast before going back out on the road. Dan tried to call Emily to let him know that he was all right, but she didn't answer any of the numbers he tried to call. "I'll have an agent get a hold of her and let her know," Beasley assured him. They went over the route that they would take. "We'll check in with the agency when we get to Uniontown," she told him. "I should get in a good nap between now and then." Beasley woke up in the passenger seat about 3 miles outside of Uniontown, Pennsylvania. After making a quick call on the cell phone she carried, she instructed Dan to keep driving till they got to Little Washington. "We'll get some lunch before we head into Ohio. We should be in Magnolia right around dinner time," she informed Dan. "And by the way, thanks for taking the wheel." "My pleasure," he grinned. "Well, I thought you might like it. You were hell on wheels in your younger days, as I understand it." Dan nodded in agreement. "So how does someone like you go from being a rowdy little bastard into a minister? I don't understand." "There are times I don't understand myself," Dan replied. Most everyone in town thinks it has something to do with my talking with Pastor Kello on a regular basis. Thinking back, he had a way of nudging people in a particular direction. There are quite a few preachers in the area who preach hellfire and brimstone. Pastor Kello had a way of talking people in or taking people in and making them feel comfortable. The interviews we've done indicate that you do the same thing, Beasley pointed out. You exude love without all that messy judgment that I've seen from a lot of preachers I've met in my lifetime. Your buddy in Davis is one of them. Agent Hamner is another. James is a preacher? Well, not properly, she amended her statement. He talks about God and stuff from time to time. Again, not in a pushy way. Dan smiled. He only had a short time to converse with Agent Hamner, but found himself wanting to get to know the man a little better. I've been following this case for past several months now. You know, the one with all the church burnings? Every last one of the preachers involved are just like you. Quiet, unassuming, and approachable. I'd like to talk with people like you, people who don't shove God and Jesus down my throat. Well, maybe your suspect is someone who'd rather hear fire and brimstone preaching on a Sunday morning, Dan suggested. Well, there's definitely a pattern there, Beasley admitted. Our investigation seems to support that theory as well as another. Oh, you mean about the perpetrator being ex-army? Yeah, James must have told you. Yes, he did, Dan confirmed. Then there's what we saw the other night out on Dolly Sods, Beasley reminded him. If the man or the sheriff is our guy, it might explain why all the subterfuge. I think the sheriff knows a lot more than he's letting on. In fact, I think that the reason he's after you is to cover his own tracks. I'm not a detective, but I came to that conclusion when I saw the two of them together, Dan stated. Look, I'm just an artist who happens to work for a bunch of detectives, Beasley protested. I don't catch on to certain things as quickly as other people. Give me a break, will you? You did say something to James about what happened on the mountain the other night, right? Well, yeah, I was debriefed shortly after we got back. Now, why are we running? Why isn't the sheriff being questioned and perhaps jailed? Part of it's politics, Beasley explained. Folks in Tucker County love the man. He's not much of a sheriff, but if push comes to shove, people around here would be in revolt if we were to arrest him. What's more, every other county sheriff in West Virginia has his back, and so do the state police. Won't we be taking a risk of heading back to Ohio by way of Wheeling? Life isn't without risks, Pastor. You should know that. Once the sheriff figures out that his deputies were chasing a bait car, he'd figure out that we were either staying put up at the timberline or heading south past the state park. He'd assume he'd lost us. I'm like you were back in your day. I know the roads and I've never been caught. Dan chuckled warmly, knowing darn good and well that she was probably right. He'd led Harold Richman on many a merry chase back when he was a teenager. Little Washington came up much too soon for Dan's liking. If it had been him, or had been a while since he'd driven something other than a minivan or a sedate sedan. After a fast food lunch, Dan asked if he could continue the drive. Maybe on the other side of Wheeling, Beasley told him. If there were any cops hiding on the interstate between Pennsylvania and the river, I know where they'd be hiding. Besides, I can't let you have all the fun. Dan agreed with her. Besides, he thought that a short nap would be advantageous. He woke up an hour and a half later at some place called Fly. Beasley had stopped and was talking with an Ohio State Highway patrolman. She was showing her badge and was explaining the situation. Well, I suppose the gentleman who is with you is who the sheriffs across the river are looking for, the patrolman postulated. Well, I suppose you're right, Beasley agreed. Truth is, he's my problem. You don't need to concern yourself, officer. Well, I suppose I could look the other way while you mosey down the road, little lady. Dan winced. He didn't suppose that D. Beasley liked what the policeman just called her. She just smiled, thanked him, and went on down the road. 5 miles later, she stopped and told Dan it was his turn to drive the rest of the way. Little lady indeed, she harumped. I have half a mind to go back and give that man what for. Dan said nothing while she stewed in the passenger seat for the rest of the trip. He was enjoying the drive. Chapter 29. Dan and Beasley arrived in front of Dan's house shortly after four to find Agent Barada sitting on the porch talking on his cell phone. Good to see you made it, and pretty much on time too, Barada greeted them after putting his phone aside. I was just on the phone with Jim Hamner. Seems that the Tucker County Sheriff is about to have kittens over your escape. Measly laughed and then introduced herself to the local agent while Dan went into the house. "Where's Emily?" he asked when he came back a minute or two later. "Your wife went with Lizzie Elston over to the cabin Lizzie has over in Highland County," Agent Barada informed the pastor. "They're back at the bed and breakfast waiting for you." "I take it the kids are with their grandparents?" "Yes, they went up to Kelly's Island. They'll be back tomorrow night." "I suppose we should head over to the Blue and Gray," Dan told Beasley. "You'll need a place to stay the night before heading back home." "I've already booked a room for her," Barada told him. "You go on ahead. I need to debrief Beasley and catch her up on some late developments. Take her car. I'll drive over when we're ready." Dan drove over to the Blue and Gray to find Emily, Lizzie, and Tricia Michaels out on the front porch. The car barely came to a stop when Emily rushed him. "Thank God you're safe," she sobbed. "I was worried sick about you." Several minutes of reassurance later, Dan and Emily walked up to the front porch to greet the others. "Well, I hear you had a little excitement while you were in West Virginia," Tricia quipped while he approached. "You have no idea," Dan replied. "We had some excitement ourselves," Lizzie spoke up. "We've seen the same person you've been seeing in West Virginia." "When?" "Today. He was in Zeke's this morning and out in our cabin just a few hours ago, before he blew it up." "We think Vera Mace was his mother," Emily added. "If she wasn't, she was at least helping him." "You may want to see what I've laid out on the parlor," Tricia told him. She ushered everyone into the parlor where she set up a computer and several books on a card table over by the fireplace. There are several photographs laid out on the table, too. One caught Dan's eye. "That's the guy," he said softly, picking up an 8x10 photo. "In Zeke's?" "Yep, in Zeke's." "When was this taken? Who took it?" He saw the time and date stamp as well as a notation of the camera location. "Security cam footage this morning," Tricia stated. "It was taken at 6:37, just as he was leaving. Looks a lot like the drawing the FBI artist had sent over to Emily." "That's the guy," Dan repeated. "He's the same one I saw in West Virginia. Any idea who he is?" he asked. "Oh, we know who he is, all right," she stated. "We?" "Well, I started writing a story about the burning churches the morning your friend's church burned down in West Virginia," Tricia began. "I didn't really start to write about church fires. Rather, I was working on some genealogical background for Lizzie and her friend Mr. Clark. The fellow came in as a side note." Dan wondered if Lizzie had told the reporter the same thing Lizzie told him in confidence about Lizzie's secret marriage. "Clark had a stepbrother, you know. His father got mixed up with a woman before he married Clark's mother. Clark's stepbrother became a father to an illegitimate child, too, with a woman from West Virginia. She raised their son while he went, cleaned up his act, and got elected sheriff of Tucker County," Dan concluded, ending Tricia's sentence. She nodded her head. "This," she said, picking up the picture, "is the sheriff's illegitimate son, Charles Peter Clark, better known as Buddy." "How do you know his name?" Dan asked. "Army. He served a couple of tours in Iraq and Afghanistan as a demolitions expert." Dan let the information soak in a few minutes. "A firebug." "Apparently," Tricia agreed. "At least that's what Barada and that other guy, the new one on the case, Cavallo, seemed to think. Barada will be here in a couple of minutes. Cavallo went out to Highland County to investigate the fire at Bob and Lizzie's place out there. Lizzie and Emily watched Buddy set the place on fire and leave with his mother, Vera Mace." Mention of the woman's name hit Dan hard. He thought of her as being mostly harmless. Abrasive, yes, but mostly harmless. Now this. "Are you certain?" Dan asked. "We're about 90% certain," she told him. "From what I've been able to determine from the Army, Buddy joined the service 7 years ago when he was living in a small town in Pennsylvania. He listed his next of kin as his mother, Vera Whistler. She married a man who raised Buddy as his own until the boy was 17. Vernon Whistler drove his car over an embankment into a creek. The coroner stated the cause of death is a heart attack. Vera went off the deep end for a while, and Buddy went into the Army. Vera was taken in by Pastor Simmons. Simmons' wife wasn't paying him attention. Vera was more than willing, and the next thing you know, Simmons is run out of town for having an affair with Vera. I thought Pastor Simmons was happily married, Dan stated. I've met his wife. I mean, she seems nice enough. Yeah, but she's closing in on 300 pounds, Tricia pointed out. I don't know for sure, but I suspect that Penny Simmons stays married to the pastor only for appearance sake. Does the agency know? Dan asked. I filled them in, Tricia told him. Emmy and Lizzie's first-hand account of the fire in Highland County confirmed my research. I take it that Miss Mace's in custody. She's missing, Emily said. Maybe dead. Her house went up in flames a few hours ago. Beasley and Barada arrived just after the revelations had been made. The information was shared again after instructions. After a quick conference, Dan and Agent Barada decided to go up to see the remains of the house on the River Road, while Emily, Lizzie, and Beasley stayed behind. Chapter 30. Who are they? Dan asked Agent Barada as they approached the scene of the fire. The man on the left is Jacob Evans. He's with the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, Barada informed the pastor. The other fellow's Eric Cavallo. He's one of ours. Both of them are crack arson investigators. Cavallo directed Barada to a place to park in a yard where the smoldering ruins of a recent fire. When he was introduced to Pastor Dan, he broke into a wide smile. You, sir, are the luckiest man in the world, he said, pumping Dan's hand. He explained his connection with Emily. Well, I've heard about you, Dan told the agent. We'll have to have you over for dinner when this is all over. Sheriff Roy joined the small group almost immediately. We found a body, he said. No identification yet, but we believe it's Miss Mace. Sorry to hear that, Dan declared. She's a pain in the neck, but if it was her who died here... His voice faded away, dissolving in a silent prayer for the deceased. Dan and the investigation team spent an hour and a half combing through the hot ashes to see if there was any indication of how the fire started. Dan pointed out some of the same patterns he'd seen at the fire at Davis. James showed me what to look for when he took me to the fire out there, Dan revealed. I wish he was here. He's a good man. You have a sharp eye, Cavallo complimented the pastor. Have you ever considered changing careers? I've come close these past few days, Dan replied. Someone showed me that I'm just fine if I'm fine doing just what I've been doing. A few minutes later, Dan noticed a patch of bronze within the wreckage. He bent down to retrieve a pair of plaques missing from the collection at the community church. Looking further, he found an unburnt envelope containing a card as well as a pair of plaques he recognized from one of his former churches. Lodi, he mumbled. Why the church at Lodi? The answer made itself known too quickly for Dan's liking. Lodi must burn. The card was handwritten, is filled with malice in just three words. Lodi must burn. He pocketed the card and searched some more. He found a dozen other similar envelopes containing similar threats and similar plaques from honor rolls like the one destroyed in the fire at Magnolia. Found something? Agent Bob Barada's voice cut through Dan's concentration concerning the cards and what they might mean. Yeah, look here, he said, showing the FBI agent his find. I wonder if these might tie into the fire James Hamner was telling me about. Barada looked in the envelopes he'd been handed, then summoned the other two investigators. We need to take these over to our team in West Virginia and see what they have to say about this, Cavallo stated. Well, Beasley may know something, Dan suggested. She's back at the Blue and the Gray with Emmy and Miss Lizzie. Well, come on, let's go back and find out, Barada said, heading back to his car. Dan and Barada were back at the bed and breakfast inside of 10 minutes. Barada took Beasley aside to show her Dan's find. Dan and Emily made plans to go home to have dinner. You could stay, Lizzie Elston suggested. We could, but we need some time alone, Emily countered. We'll come by and catch up in the morning. Would you like to use my car, Beasley offered. We can take our van, Dan stated. By the way, Emmy, where did you park it? It's blown to bits, courtesy of your local arsonist, Lizzie informed him. Dan looked over at Emily. She nodded to let him know that Lizzie had told him the truth. They took advantage of Beasley's offer, driving to Ding's up in Prentice for an intimate dinner, followed by an early bedtime at their house. The situation will certainly resolve itself in the morning, Emily assured her husband while they got settled for the night. I guess so, he agreed. I guess so. Dan woke up at 1:30, barely 3 hours after going to bed. Lodi. Why Lodi? The question rolled around his head for a few times, keeping him awake. Why Lodi? He really didn't like his time there. He recalled wanting another job almost as soon as he accepted the job as youth pastor. Why Lodi? He wandered the empty house while Emily slept. It seemed as if the only way to cure his restlessness would be a drive. Dan put on some clothes, grabbed his wallet and the keys to Beasley's car, kissed Emily on the forehead, and then took off. Prentice wasn't too far. And Columbus wasn't either. And before he knew it, he was on the interstate headed north and east. By the time he passed Delaware, he knew that he wouldn't stop until he was in Lodi. He had to know why. And as much as he loathed working there, he felt as if it was his fate to go there, to keep the place he loathed from meeting the same fate as the church in Davis, as well as his church, Magnolia. Two more chapters to go. That will be next Thursday. Hopefully it will be in much better or finer fettle and the like. And all I can say is, well, see you out there.